For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the show all about audiobooks recorded at the RNIB Talking Books Studios. I'm your host, Red Sail, and today we've got three books that find hope in adversity. Harriet Shawcross discusses the awkwardness of silence in her book, Unspeakable.
The beginning of the book looks at children that develop a phobia of speaking called selective mutism, and it looks at how not being able to say what you want to say affects you as a person.
Carolina Setterwall reveals how writing helped her negotiate her way through bereavement.
This wasn't supposed to happen to me. This happens to other people. Not me, not my son, not my partner, not my life.
And Zena Cooper takes an upbeat view of what you can see when you can't see. That's all coming up in today's Read On. When Harriet Shawcross was 13, she stopped speaking for almost a year. It's something that the journalist and filmmaker feels profoundly shaped her life. In her book, Unspeakable, The Things We Cannot Say, she explores the awkward place that silence occupies in our lives.
My silence began in the Volvo. It was my father's car, with a towel for the dog draped across the back seat and forgotten Yorkie wrappers in the footwell. I couldn't tell you the day I stopped talking, but I can place it, point to it, feel my way into it almost. And for me, it was the Volvo, driving through the half-light of winter mornings, the flash and flare of headlights and the dead space of the commute. I remember being told once that during the Iranian Revolution, cars became figured as a space beyond politics, somewhere no one could see what was happening, safe from the secret police, immune from surveillance, where you could kiss or talk without being heard, somewhere anything could happen. The Volvo felt a bit like that.
Harriet Shawcross narrating her book, Unspeakable. And Harriet joined me down the line from her home in London. Harriet Shawcross, welcome to Read On.
Thank you for having me.
Unspeakable is a fascinating tour of our awkward relationship with silence. For those who haven't yet read the book, could you just give us an outline as to where it takes us?
Sure. I always worry about giving these kind of outlines because it sounds incredibly broad, but I promise it all makes sense in the context of the book. So the jumping off point for this for me was a period in my life when I was about 13 when I didn't really speak to people at school for about a year. And it was very formative. It had quite a profound effect on my life. And later in life, I went back to look at that year and why it was that I'd stopped speaking. And I guess I became fascinated by what that does to you as a person. And that led me into the beginning of the book looks at children that develop a phobia of speaking called selective mutism. And it looks at how not being able to say what you want to say affects you as a person, what that's like. So I guess the experience can enforce silence. And then it kind of takes a bit of a left-hand turn and goes into looking at different forms of, as you say, silent and unspeakable things. So it looks at taboos. So I speak to Eve Ensler, who wrote The Vagina Monologues, who very much believes that the female body is something that should be talked about and that shrouding female sexuality in silence is profoundly damaging. It looks at the history of the Samaritans and Chad Barrow's desperate desire to enable people to talk about things that they had no outlet for anywhere else. And for him, a lot of that was also connected to sex and sexuality. And then I went to Nepal after the earthquake a couple of years ago and spent some time with some anthropologists and psychologists who were looking at the effect of talking on trauma. So whether talking about terrible things that happen to you actually helps you process them, or whether trauma actually lives in a different bit of the brain and the idea of talking your way out of it makes no sense at all. And then the book ends by going back to silence and looking at that in a bit more detail. So I spoke to a lot of people that had spent a lot of time in silence, probably more than any of the rest of us would want to. So that's people from a religious context. I spoke to an artist who spent nearly a year in silence. And so it's looking at what that kind of silence does to you, as opposed to the silence the book begins with, that enforced silence. What happens if it's a choice? And can it be a positive thing? And is it in fact something that we could probably all do with a bit more of in our lives?
I began to hide in the boot room during breakfast. Rows of metal cages and heavy cloaks, used only once a year for the carol service, made it an easy place to disappear. Trunks and tuck boxes were stacked to the ceiling, and the air smelt of sweat and linseed oil. No one was ever there for more than a few minutes to collect a lacrosse stick or a textbook. "Oh, hi," they would say. "I didn't see you there." "Yeah, sorry, I was just leaving," I'd reply. "Cool." No one guessed I'd been standing there for an hour, pretending to have just arrived. My days were bookended by awkward pauses in the boot room, and as time went on, the silence began to swell, until I found I had nothing to say. I never intended to stop talking, but soon keeping quiet became a habit. I felt the silence settling on me in the Volvo as we drove down the hill towards the gates. It felt safer, easier somehow, to say the bare minimum. I would answer direct questions from teachers or other girls, but I lost the art of conversation. Looking back, I find it hard to pinpoint exactly when my silence took hold in those first few years of secondary school, or to know how long it lasted. What is imprinted on my memory are individual moments, the unallocated pauses between classes, when the other girls would be saving seats and drawing biro tattoos on the backs of their hands as I looked on. I knew my behaviour was odd and would try and will myself to speak, but I didn't know how to break into their conversations. Weeks would pass when I said little more than, "Yeah, cool, thanks." I was never bullied, just ignored.
I was fascinated to see the links that you were drawing between what is unspoken and what is unspeakable. You identify fairly early on in the book that the reason you lost the art of conversation at school was partly to do with your father's redundancy at home, which was one of those things that shouldn't be talked about outside the family home, and also partly because you were a day girl at a boarding school and the teachers didn't want you to make the other children feel homesick by talking about your home life. So in some ways you were speaking a foreign language to those around you and lost the art of communication.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It was that kind of double whammy of starting off in this very prestigious academic school and being told quite explicitly, don't talk about life at home, and taking that to heart. And then there was this huge shame around my father being made redundant. Certainly at home, the phrase blood runs thicker than water was one that was definitely said. And it was this idea that there are aspects of our life that shouldn't be spoken about. So I think for me at that age, shame was a massive part of why I wasn't able to talk about what was actually happening for me.
I think that's something that would really resonate with lots of blind people, that actually, certainly my generation, and I'm not that much older than you, was not expected to speak openly about your loss of sight for the fear of upsetting other people. And so it led to feelings of shame and embarrassment, which just perpetuates your own awkwardness, because if you're not bearing witness to your experience, then how can anybody even begin to understand your experience?
Wow, that's so interesting. I hadn't heard that.
Certainly it's something that you come to talk about with Eve Ensler, about bearing witness to one's experience and not being afraid to vocalise what your thoughts are. And bearing in mind that this is a family show, maybe we won't go too deep into some of the language that's used, but it's very much about owning one's story by telling one's story.
That's it, exactly. So I don't know if people know the story of the Vagina Monologues. So it basically happened that Eve is this American playwright. She's in her 60s, and this was back in the early 90s, that she was interviewing women and talking to them about their bodies. And she put together this series of monologues, which are fictional, but they're based on over 200 factual interviews. And what she was expecting was that she'd go on stage and she'd get stories of people talking about their sex lives or great fulfillment. But what she actually found was that once she'd started to speak about the female body, people were coming up to her after the show and telling her terrible stories of being raped, being abused, of incest, and she herself is a sexual abuse survivor. And she's very clear that it was something about giving people a space in which to speak about the taboo and to tell their stories had an incredibly powerful effect and unleashed lots of stories about sexual violence that she was absolutely not expecting and was not really her intention when she wrote the play. But since then, she's become an activist, and much of her work focuses around sexual violence and enabling women to tell their stories. And a lot of what she was doing in the early 90s prefigures much of the Me Too movement that happened in the last couple of years.
Now, you say, again, early on in the book, that that period of silence shaped your life in some ways for ill, but in some ways for good. I thought it was fascinating that when you went on your hostage awareness course in Afghanistan, you were told that the way to survive as a hostage is to become a grey man, somebody who doesn't say anything.
So this is one of these strange things that the BBC does. I'm a filmmaker and I've been to Afghanistan several times. And before you go to hostile environment, the BBC trains you in, you know, hostile environment training. So it's what to do if you're kidnapped or your car is hijacked or whatever. And so it's a very surreal experience. It's in the home counties and they simulate a kidnap and you end up with a bag over your head, separated from your colleagues in a warehouse on your own. And it's to see how you cope. And the advice we were given was, as you say, to become this grey man. So it's not being completely silent and obstructive and not answering questions, but it's also not being too vociferous, not offering too much. It's giving just enough that you become slightly invisible. You're not that noticeable. You're not a problem to the hostage takers, like, effectively. And what was interesting for me was that that survival mode of communication, of just saying the bare minimum, really rang true to me. That seemed to me pretty much what I was doing as a teenager, just blending into the background and trying to disappear a bit.
And you also point out that it's made you a very good listener. I think the expression you use, a lurker on the fringes of people's conversations, which obviously is fed into your career as a journalist and a filmmaker.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so much of particularly being a filmmaker, I think, is having that ability to disappear a little bit. So countless times I've said, no, I'm not here, talk to the camera, don't talk to me. And you'll know this in an interview. It's being able to use silence and not being scared of it and knowing that sometimes silence is a great way of eliciting things from people and that people will reveal themselves if they're given that base. But I guess conversationally, silence is something that we're taught to shy away from. So I do think that having had that experience of saying very little did actually play a part in perhaps the professional choices I've made and maybe why I enjoy doing this job so much.
Something else that it clearly helped with and that you have been able to help other people with was your time at the Samaritans, where actually knowing when not to say something is probably more important than anything else.
Absolutely. I love the Samaritans. I could talk about them all day. I was a volunteer for 10 years. And in the course of researching the book, I went and spoke to someone called Alan, who's the longest serving volunteer. He's been volunteering at Liverpool Samaritans since 1960, which is kind of remarkable. And I was asking him about the Samaritan art of listening, and he described it using this amazing phrase and called it benevolent darkness. So the idea of Samaritan listening is, in a way, it's the opposite of conversation. So if conversationally I was to say to you that I was having suicidal thoughts, your first impulse will probably be to say, oh, well, you've got so much to live for. There's this, this, this. And have you thought of this? And pulling me away from what I'm actually expressing. Whereas Samaritan listening is going with you into that darkness and allowing you to say and to explore what you need to say without putting any of my own stuff in the way, if that makes sense. And silence is absolutely at the heart of that and of giving people the space to articulate things that they may well have never said to anybody else.
Did you find it easy to go back into the dark silence that you first experienced as a teenager in researching this book? I know you felt a compulsion to do so, but I get the impression reading some of the chapters that it was actually very painful and uncomfortable.
I guess so. I mean, I think the main thing about silence, for me anyway, is that it's 100% dependent on the conditions in which it occurs. So if it's chosen, that's very different to feeling that you physically cannot say what needs to be said. As a teenager, I knew that my behaviour was very strange, but couldn't snap myself out of it. Whereas in the book, I go on several silent retreats and talk to these people that have spent a long time in silence. And you're right, like the second silent retreat particularly was quite unpleasant. But I think there's a huge difference because that silence is, A, very controlled and boundaried. The conditions of a silent retreat are that if you really need to talk to someone, you can, and it's in a communal setting. It's something that everybody's doing, and it's chosen. And I think that is what makes the crucial difference between being in solitary confinement in a prison and being a monk in a monastery, for example. Like, one is vocation, one is punishment, but they're effectively the same thing. There were times when it was unpleasant, certainly, but I think different because in this sense, because it was being done for research and because it was chosen, it's slightly different.
Although I did feel you squirming a bit when you went to the boot camp for selectively mute children in the United States, where they were being cajoled, almost forced into speaking, which is kind of, well, if selective mutism is a phobia, then that's extreme exposure to the thing that you're phobic about.
Yeah, exactly. So selective mutism, it's a really tricky one. And like in the past, kids that had it, it was thought that they were being difficult or they were obstructive or they were shy. And it often just wasn't picked up on because often they'll do very well at school. They may not be talking, but they will do what they need to do to get by. And I don't know how much your listeners will know about it as a condition, but basically what it means is that a child is able to talk in certain circumstances, but not in others. So most commonly, it's when kids go to school that their child might be very chatty at home and suddenly they're not really talking in the classroom environment. But it can also be within a family that a child can't talk to their dad or can't talk to their grandparents or whatever it is. And most commonly it's in young children and it can be treated. But this camp I went to in the States was for teenagers, so 13 to 15 year olds, and they were quite extreme cases. So by that stage, for some of the 15-year-olds, who were mainly girls, interestingly, weren't talking at school at all to anyone and hadn't been for years, but had come through the school system quite happily up to the age of 15 because they were doing the assignments, they were doing what was required, they just didn't have any friends. And that was something that a lot of the parents said to me, was that all they wanted for their children was just to be able to make friends, that was their hope for this camp. Boot camp is possibly the wrong word, but it was an American summer camp of a week to try and get these kids, who in many cases were very severely selectively mute, to be able to interact. And the way they did that was, so the camp slogan was like, get comfortable with being uncomfortable. So it was trying to push these kids into being able to speak. And in the UK, SM is treated much more at the child's pace. It's taking things very, very slowly. It's removing the pressure to speak, if anything. It's not making a big deal of it if a child does speak. Whereas in the States, it was congratulating every time a child did anything. It was this constant pressure. And you're right, that was quite difficult to watch. But that said, all the parents I spoke to at that camp were happy that they'd gone. They felt it had made a difference. And for all of them, pretty much, they said they felt like it was a last resort and they were willing to try anything at this point. So who am I to judge, I guess? Often with SM, you get this blank affect. So it's actually a very strange feeling. You go into this classroom and the way it was arranged was each child had a mentor next to them. So that's someone in their early 20s who was there to help facilitate and help them to speak. But very often the kids with SM were very flat to look at. So not laughing, not giggling, not chatting, not in the way that you would expect a group of 13-year-olds to be. So it was really unnerving, actually. There was a lot of noise, but it was from the mentors often who were trying to encourage the kids to speak. But often it was very, very difficult to read anything off the children. And I was there filming, so I spent a lot of time watching their faces. That is really interesting, but kind of emotionally they seemed very, very flat.
Well, it's a fascinating view into a silent world, a world that actually I think those of us who spend so much time listening to the nuance of what people are saying and how they say it. I mean, in my case, it made me think, how would I survive in a world where the majority of people didn't communicate verbally? And it's clearly very much your story to tell. Is that why you chose to narrate the audiobook yourself?
Oh, that's interesting. I think it was basically because I felt that I would do as good a job as anyone else. And parts of the book are very personal. And yeah, I felt it may as well be me doing it. It was quite a strange experience, though, because I'd never narrated an audiobook before. And I hadn't really thought that you're narrating it effectively to one person. There is the sound engineer sitting next door, who was this absolutely charming guy in his early 20s. And when it got to some of the personal, particularly some of the sexual stuff, it felt a little bit uncomfortable. But yes, I think it was just the feeling of, well, it may as well be me that does it.
Do you think that experience of narrating the book and actually of writing the book as well has helped you accept and absorb the silence that you identify as having had repercussions throughout your life?
Yes, undoubtedly. It was a very cathartic experience, and I'm very lucky to have had the opportunity to do it, to go back into your own story and look at the series of events and make sense of everything. So yeah, undoubtedly, it was very cathartic.
And are you working on another book now?
I absolutely should be, right this very minute. I am. I'm trying to put together a proposal for another book about families, but it's a bit vague at the moment, so I'm not sure how well I'll be able to articulate it. But effectively, it's looking at what ties families together, the importance of genetic links, and the phenomenon of modern day family making, whether that's through donor conception or surrogacy or anything else. And that's something that's very close to my heart, because my wife and I are going to have a baby and she's donor conceived. And I think that experience of family building where there isn't a blood tie is something that's very interesting and all the more pertinent nowadays, because it's something that's happening more and more, particularly as women have children older, the increase in egg donation, etc. So yes, I am meant to be doing that, but it's going quite slowly.
Well, best of luck with the birth of your first child. And
thank you
for taking me into a world that I otherwise would have known very, very little about.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Harriet Shawcross, thank you for being a guest on Read On.
My parents didn't realise what was happening. I didn't know how to tell my father on the long drive home that I'd barely said a word since we had parted that morning. And once I was back in the familiar surroundings of home, I found I could talk normally again. I was ashamed of my silence and feared I must have done something terribly wrong if no one wanted to talk to me.
Unspeakable, The Things We Cannot Say, written and narrated by Harriet Shawcross, is out now in print, ebook, and audio, wherever you buy your books. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews, and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, listener and author Zena Cooper shares her story of friendship, fortitude, and a guide dog called Munch. But first, Carolina Setterwall's debut novel, Let's Hope for the Best, was inspired by the sudden death of her husband soon after the birth of their first child. It's an achingly honest memoir, exploring the making and ending of life. Carolina joined me in the London studio. Carolina Setterwall, welcome to Read On.
Thank you so much.
So the events that form the basis of Let's Hope for the Best actually happened. Can you take us through them?
Yes. In 2014, I was a mother for the first time. My son was 8 months old and my partner, Axel, was the same age as I, and we had lived together for 5 years. And he died one night in his sleep out of nowhere. So I unfortunately had the experience of waking up one morning and having my life ripped apart. I became a single mother and I fell deep into grief and depression, I think. And I had to find a way to make life move on because I had my son and I wanted him to have a future. So that was what happened to me. And a few years later, I ended up writing a book and a story about a woman who goes through the kind of exact same thing. So that's the background of it.
And was it easier to write it as a novel rather than a straight bereavement memoir?
Yes, I think that from the beginning, I always thought of it as a novel because I thought that the important thing I want to tell is not my personal story, but a story about grief, a grief that I thought that I would have liked to have read myself, because I felt really alone in my grief during the worst, like the darkest days. I felt that my grief was kind of ugly because I was so angry and I was so envious of all the people that still had their people around. And I felt really guilty about things that I had done and been with my partner who was dead. So I wanted to tell a story, but not specifically my story. So I thought of it as a novel all the time. And some elements in the book is definitely fiction, and many elements is, they're really true.
I think also when grief strikes you at such a comparatively young age, we're not brought up to feel that bereavement happens to us. It's something that happens later in life. So perhaps it was also a way of reflecting that.
Yeah, I think so too. And also, when it happened to me, one of my first thoughts afterwards was, I can't believe this happened to me. This wasn't supposed to happen to me. This happens to other people, not me, not my son, not my partner, not my life. And it took a long while for me just to accept that it did. But when I wrote the story, as I said, I just felt that I wanted to tell the story about grief and the way to grieve and a way to try to find a new meaning with a life that's not what you expected it to be. And I didn't feel that it was important that exactly what had happened to me or not, because I knew what kind of story I wanted to write.
Well, many of those feelings and reactions to grief are things that will really strike accord with people who have lost their sight. There's that same sense of anger and powerlessness, and this shouldn't be happening to me.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Certainly in reading the book, I found many echoes of that. There's also the sense you threw your energies into the immediate problem, the problem that you could solve, which was bringing up your very, very young son. He was only 8 months old, yeah. Ivan, at that stage.
Yes.
And you reflect that actually you can overdo it in trying to solve the one problem that you feel you can solve. You can go too far.
Exactly. I think I went too far. But then again, it's like when this happened, for me to have a son who was 8 months old and then 9 and then 10 and so on, it gave my days a purpose, because children, you just need to give them a new diaper or nappy, or you have to help them to fall asleep and take a walk and go to a park. And everything was kind of simple just to focus on him, because his needs were really easy for me to see. But the future seemed impossible to imagine.
Well, yes, there's a real sense that actually you're neglecting yourself whilst pouring your energies into your son and keeping him alive.
Yeah, I think I wanted to like pretend. My goal with the days was that he would laugh, he would have a good day, he would meet people that loved him, and he would have me present as possible. And it took me a long while to even feel that I had the time and energy to even listen to what I felt and what I wanted to do. I didn't have a clue. So I just kept on focusing on him.
Now, you write the book in chapters that alternate between past and present.
Yeah.
Reflecting, actually, the ups and downs of quite a turbulent relationship with Axel, and searching for meaning and maybe clues in that part of the relationship, and then reflecting forward to the present. Was it difficult writing about parts of your life that might put you and possibly Axel in an unflattering light?
Both yes and no, because the purpose for me was to share a relationship and a grief process that wasn't like the perfect one. Most relationships, in my experience, have their ups and downs. And then between the ups and downs, there are millions of days in between, you know, gray Tuesdays when you eat pasta in front of the TV. I wanted these parts of the relationship to be in the book, because most are days, at least mine, were like that. And to me, that was like capturing the love and the life that we shared, but also to look at all my mistakes and the parts of our relationship where I thought that I was kind of a bad person. I wouldn't have thought that if he lived and our relationship just kept on going. But since he died so unexpectedly, it was hard for me to forgive myself for being a negative partner, one that was nagging on him for working less and being more present and doing things in my pace rather than his. And we had these things that couples do have, I think, quite often. Like one wants to do things fast and move on in life, and one wants to sit back and think and maybe decide tomorrow or the day after that. I think we were a fairly normal couple, but when he died, everything seemed like every mistake I ever made seemed so unforgivable.
And the book starts with an extraordinary clue to what's going to happen. 4 months before his death, Axel had sent you an email with "If I die" in the subject line and his computer password.
Yeah.
And that's an amazing starting point for the book. Did you feel that maybe there was something you'd missed seeing?
Yes, definitely. I still do sometimes when I look through the old pictures of us and him. I sit there and I try to understand when he got ill. Doesn't he look a bit weaker than usual from this point on? And all the pictures of him and Ivan in the last few weeks or maybe months, he looks really tired, and he's always down on the floor with Ivan, playing, half laying on the floor. And I think that's a way for me and my mind to get some control. I missed something, obviously. But nobody, not even the doctors afterwards, can say exactly when he fell ill or if it would be able to save him if it had happened, if we knew, because it happened very suddenly. He had a heart muscle disease that nobody knew of. But yes, I go back a lot and I try to understand things.
Has his family been very supportive of the book?
I wouldn't say very, but to me, the fact that they're supportive at all, that's big enough. It's really hard for them to have lost a son and a brother and still having to deal with me writing about it and doing interviews about it and sharing our story. That's the parts about me and him is my perspective. It's not the whole picture. It's not like the objective truth about who he was. That was a period of time that I shared with him in my view.
Now, the book is not only about death, it is also about life, your son Ivan's life, and without giving any spoilers, about your re-entry into a greater enjoyment of life. And again, without giving any spoilers, it ends on a bit of a cliffhanger. And yes. I understand you have a two-book deal, so hopefully we're going to find out what happens next.
Yes, we'll see, we'll see. I'm writing on something right now. It's actually not Let's Hope for the Best Part 2, but if people are curious about what happens after the book ends, it's one Google away, I think, because, yeah, it's out there.
The book is very accessible, as I say, to anybody who's had a sense of loss and maybe needs a little bit of guidance in how to step out of that well of darkness and back into the light. I hear that there should also be an audiobook version on the way soon.
Yes, so I heard too.
Have you had anything to do with the choosing of the narrator?
No, not here. In Sweden I could do that. So we should choose a girl that's a musician and whose voice I really, really love. She's not an actor. And I wanted it to be read rather than acted, my book. But here, I don't know. It's going to be really exciting to listen to it.
And you're pleased with the English translation?
Yes, I am. It felt weird to read these words when I think if I would have written it in English, I'm kind of good at English, but it's not my first language. So sometimes it was like, I think maybe I would have used this sentence and or this melody. But overall, I'm really, really happy about it and impressed and everything.
And whilst we're waiting for the audiobook to be produced, you very kindly agreed to read a passage from the book for us.
Yes, and I choose a passage in the beginning of the book so that I won't spoil too much. And it's actually the morning that I come into the bedroom and find my partner in bed. I think I should say that I haven't slept in that bedroom because I had slept in Ivan's bedroom because he was nursing all the time during the nights at that time. I wake up almost rested. The cat hasn't been whining outside Ivan's room, as she sometimes does, and Ivan only needed to breastfeed 2 times after his outburst just before midnight. He's in a good mood, ready to crawl out of our temporary bed on the floor, aiming for the door and an adventure in the rest of the apartment. I lift him up, tell him it's time to go and wake up Daddy. When I open the door, the cat's waiting for us and allows us to pet her. She too seems newly awake. We all head towards your room. I put Ivan down on the bed so he can crawl over to you, be the first thing you see when you open your eyes. I say, "Good morning, Daddy," in that tone I use when I'm speaking to Ivan but directing my words towards another adult. I mostly do this to you. Ivan takes aim for your head, but before he can really get going, I notice that something is wrong. The way you're lying is unusual, crooked and bent, in fetal position, your face pressed against a pillow. There's also something odd about your skin. It's paler than usual, lifeless.
Wow.
Yes.
Well, Carolina Sitterwell, thank you so much for sharing Let's Hope for the Best with the Read On listeners. And good luck with the rest of your life stepping back out into the light.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Let's Hope for the Best by Carolina Sitterwell is out now in hardback and ebook with an audio version on the way.
It's not difficult to donate a little to RNIB. In fact, it's as easy as treating yourself to the latest CD, digital device, or Amazon Echo. Raise money for RNIB whilst you shop at Amazon. Amazon Smile is a simple and automatic way for you to support RNIB every time you shop, at no cost to you. When you next sign in to Amazon, use the address www.smile.amazon.co.uk and nominate RNIB as your charity of choice. The webpage looks exactly like amazon.co.uk and it remembers all of your login details, order history, wish lists, wedding lists, etc. But importantly, RNIB will receive 0.5% of the net sale of most goods that you can buy on the site. It's that easy to donate. Tell your friends and family how simple it is to donate to RNIB every time you shop on Amazon, simply by using www.smile.amazon.co.uk. Treat yourself on Amazon and support your favourite charity while you shop.
The Moth.
I'm Jay Ellison. Join us for more true personal stories told live on stage. No scripts, no notes, no nothing. Each Moth Radio Hour is a mix of funny and heartbreaking tales that captivate and surprise and delight audiences around the world with their honesty and bravery and humor. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Wednesdays from 8 p.m. and Sundays at 11 a.m. on RNIB Connect Radio.
Now, before we return to hear the books of Carolina Setterwall's life, what you can see when you can't see is Zena Cooper's story of learning to see beauty in the world despite losing her sight. Part memoir, part self-help guide, it's an uplifting tale of friendship, fortitude and a guide dog called Munch. Zena joined me down the line from her home in Wales. Zena Cooper, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
Now, you've lived with sight loss all your life, haven't you? You were born with Marfan syndrome?
Yes, I was born with Marfan syndrome and it was diagnosed when I was four. Yes, that was the first inkling we had that I had issues in my eyesight, even though I knew before that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and effectively that means that your tissue doesn't connect properly in various parts of your body, including your eyes.
Yeah, so Marfan syndrome is a connective tissue disorder that affects the heart, the eyes, the lungs, blood vessels, bones, joints, ligaments, kind of everything. And it depends, it's a bit of a lucky dip really, what, because everyone with Marfan syndrome has a different kind of element that they're more prone to suffer from because it affects the fibrillin 1 in the body. So some people have eye issues, some people have more cardiac issues, and some people have more skeletal problems. So there's no kind of hard or fast rule, it's just like whatever you're given really.
And you lived with significant sight problems for nearly 40 years before actually coming out and admitting that you needed a white cane. There's a lovely line in your book saying, "I lived as an imposter in the sighted world for 4 decades. Is it too late to tell them?"
Yeah, because sight loss is something that's really difficult to talk about in a way, because especially when you grow up, and if you've had sight loss from birth, that's all you know. So you get into this, you know, reality of thinking, because, you know, there's a sight loss community, and there's a sighted community, and most people live in a sighted community. So people with sight loss, you kind of stumble across them as you grow, if you know what I mean, as you get older. So that was great, but like growing up, I was the only one I knew with sight loss. Yeah, it was just difficult to say, oh gosh, by the way, I can't really see. So when I was younger, I wore glasses. That didn't do any help really, because with Marfan syndrome, lenses are so black, so like your eyesight changes from sometimes hour to hour, so it changes multiple times in the day, and it depends on lighting and glare and everything. So, you know, so some people knew I wore glasses for a little bit of my time until I had eye surgery, which made it even worse. So after that, you couldn't see any indication that I had sight loss. There was no glasses wearing, there was nothing, and it just deteriorated really. Yes, I made the decision I had to have a guide dog in the end.
And yet you made it all the way through school with your friends whispering what was on the board to you, and then managed to get to work in later life just by counting the stops on the train and counting the steps.
Yes, it sounds a bit bizarre, but if you know no different, because you kind of have these coping strategies go through life, you know, I used to recognise people's voices and going through school, you know, people used to whisper in my ear, I used to sometimes, if I could hold the book really close to my face, I'd copy up a lot, and I could kind of make out the smudges sometimes, and just, like, write down what they said, you know, what was meant to be on the blackboard. Or I used to sit back and listen to what the teacher saying as they were saying, I used to write it down, I shouldn't have been. But it was just all these kind of just different coping strategies. It kind of worked, you know, when I went through to university and everything, so it worked, I had no help in it, you know, but it just worked for me, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and you also not only went to work, but had children as well, I understand.
Yes, I got four children, teenagers of 15 and 22. So that was quite a challenge bringing them up as well. And two of them have sight loss as well. So three of them have Marfan syndrome, but just two are affected by the vision. And I've got a granddaughter as well. So yeah, but it's kind of the norm in our family, because Marfan syndrome is the norm in our family. Seven of us with it. So we kind of get each other, which is a good thing. Yeah.
And as we can hear, you're a remarkably positive person. And this has fed into your wonderful book, What You Can See When You Can't See.
I think that was the aim of it, because I think a lot of people know the devastating effects of sight loss, which it is, you know, and it takes so much away from life. And even the basics of driving and the basic day-to-day things that people take for granted is a challenge. But then there's the other side of it, there's the beauty in it. And I think the slant of the book was aimed towards that, is the positivity of it. And looking at, okay, you know, we dealt with things in life, you have to deal with something, but, like, you know, where to find the beauty in that as well.
And I think that really comes through when you're talking about the friendships and relationships that you've had throughout your life, and also the marvellous relationship you've got with Munch, your guide dog.
Yeah, he's my little odd sock, yeah. Yeah, I was really reluctant to get in a guide dog, to be fair, because I kind of had to admit to the world, I had this felt like I had a neon sign in my head saying, you know, I've got sight loss. Even though I had it from birth, it got progressively worse. But no one knew that, you know, because I was living in a sighted world, kind of undercover, you know what I mean? I threw crooked teeth, I played for the guide dog, which took 17 months, and then, you know, kind of the universe delivered the most amazing and bizarre guide dog ever. Munch, you know.
Brilliant. And he really has helped you come fully to terms with your sight loss.
Yeah, before this, I have to admit, I wasn't really a dog lover, you know, a natural dog lover. But I know I get what people mean by dog lovers. Yeah. You know what I mean? So there's that element of it. But it's the fact of, I think people are so drawn to him. And it kind of takes away the, I think it was my fear of what people think sight loss was, you know. And we kind of work well together, because apparently he doesn't look like a guide dog. It's going to be working well together. It's a good partnership.
So where did the inspiration to sit down and write the book come from? Because it's a huge amount of effort to write a book.
Yeah, I originally went to a Hay House Writers workshop, it was, back in 2017, you know, and originally started putting an idea together for another book, because I've never done writing as a profession or something, but I just like to dabble a bit. And I started writing a book about something completely different, really, and then we were in this workshop, and people kept asking so much about Munch, but sight loss as well, and I thought, well, people need to know what sight loss is, and I think I've had throughout life, and people have, some of my close friends knew I couldn't see that well, but they didn't know the extent of what I couldn't see, you know. And I was always getting asked questions, I can't imagine what you can see. So from that, I thought, okay, so what can I see? So actually, I just sat there one night and just thought, do you know what? I'm just going to start writing this, you know. And it kind of just developed into a book.
And you're also an integrative counsellor, and so it's important for you not only to help people who have sight loss come to terms with the sometimes very negative feelings that we can have about what we've lost, but also I get the impression you're wanting to help other people be supportive to those of us who've got sight loss or long-term illness.
Yes, I think adversity and disability and sight loss and everything comes kind of in one, you know, and it's just, I think towards the end of the book, there's kind of a workbook to help people kind of rethink how they think about life. And it's for people to understand what sight loss is, firstly, isn't it? And also how they can implement changes in their own life. Because some things come and go in life, health conditions, we develop some things and they leave, you know, and then, so it could just be like for a small amount of time, or some things are with you throughout. And it's just learning to kind of look at things differently, finding the beauty in whatever you're going through as well.
Yeah, looking for the positives as well as the negative. It's one of those things that's actually quite difficult to do when you've got a loss. You focus on the loss.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing, and it's definitely not about denying the loss, because the loss is important. It really, really is important, the loss is. But also, so is moving forward. And I think that's part, sometimes you know, throughout the years, you know, I've listened to so many audiobooks, which are great, you know, about loss and whatever, but sometimes it's the moving forward and how can we practically put that into daily living. And it's just about changing your thought pattern. My specialty in psychology is all about thoughts and thinking and brain and everything. And it's just about that, like acknowledging loss, but also looking forward. Like, what can we do to help ease things and help us come to terms with that and still live a daily life and as much as be as positive as we can and also progress as well. Not make sure the loss keeps us stuck, but helps us to move forward as well, because that can happen. It can actually be motivation. It's acknowledging the loss, but it's also looking at what we can do with the loss to help us move forward.
Absolutely. And, of course, it's very important for you that the book is made accessible to all of us with sight loss. And so there's an audiobook version.
Yes, it's an audiobook version. It's on the Kindle as well. It can be quite good if you've got it. It's about varying degrees of sight loss or inverted colours, and, you know, it's an audiobook and it's amazing. Yeah, I'm so happy about that. I'm really excited, yeah.
Do you listen to audiobooks yourself?
Oh, yes, masses of them.
You're a member of the R&IB library, are you?
I am, yes. It's fantastic.
Well, Zena Cooper, thank you so much. I, for one, am really looking forward to sitting down with What You Can See When You Can't See and finishing it off on audiobook. And I wish you all the very best of luck with it and hopefully with a sequel.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you so much. Thank you.
What You See When You Can't See, written by Zena Cooper, read by Janine Cooper Marshall. The poor, poor souls. What is it they see? What would it be like to see the world through their eyes? It must be awful to have vision like that. I just can't imagine what it's like for them to live with a sight, or lack of, that they have. They must miss out so much on the true meaning of life. Bless them. After all, who would want to see with perfect vision, as they're so busy looking with their eyes, they've forgotten to look with their heart? With three white cursors flashing on the dark screen, I focus in on what I think is the middle one. As each cursor merges with the next in a captivating haze, my mind starts to play, give us a clue. With four large wobbly words typed on my magnified screen, my fingers trace the keyboard for the right keys to tap away at next. I really want to stop annoying the narrator on my computer, as although she patiently alerts me to yet another mistake I've made, I'm sure I can hear her impatience grow. Is that possible? As I can only see a triple vision blurry mass in front of me, my eyes try to decipher what my fingers have typed. It looks about the size of a six-letter word that takes up the whole screen. The first letter is larger and rounded at the top, so I guess it's a B. The last letter drops down below the others, so I guess that's the Y. By this method of deduction, my brain tells me I've typed in the word beauty correctly. In an almost surprised voice, the usually narky narrator confirms it, and I feel elated. This time-consuming process is finally getting me somewhere. Typing while blind is not the easiest of tasks, but when I get it right, it's the most fulfilling feeling ever. Even if it does take what feels like an eternity to do what most people do in seconds, it's still done. In many ways, I feel like the outsider looking in on a world full of people who don't always appreciate the gifts they receive each day. The gift of being able to read words from afar has always left me speechless. When a person reads words on a sign from many feet away without needing binoculars, it feels like I'm standing next to a superhero. How people recognise others down a street without having to hear their voices is another unsolved mystery. Do they know something I don't? For the sighted, sightseeing must be a tick list haven rather than a health and safety nightmare. I've heard rumours that in the sighted world they use those superhero eyes to live in an altered state, using only their vision to live day by day. What must that be like? And yet, in other ways, it feels like I live inside the world of truth, observing many people living a half-hearted life full of voids. Seeing people not living their lives fully can be frustrating.
What You Can See When You Can't See is out now in print, ebook, and audio wherever you buy your books. Now it's back to Carolina Sitterwell for the books of her life. Carolina, was there a book that you read as a younger person that made you fall in love with reading?
Yes, I think there were several books because I was reading and listening to my parents reading a lot of Astrid Lindgren. And in Sweden, she's huge. I think probably everybody heard of her here too. I loved Astrid Lindgren because she was writing such sad stories about people dying and people not being happy all the time. And it intrigued me and it worried me. And I think it gave me a sense of that you could actually write about things that weren't only happy.
At the end of a little Swedish town lay an old, overgrown orchard. In the orchard was a cottage, and in this cottage lived Pippi Longstocking. She was 9 years old, and she lived all alone. She had neither mother nor father, which was really rather nice, for in this way there was no one to tell her to go to bed just when she was having most fun, and no one to make her take cod liver oil when she felt like eating peppermints. There was a time when Pippi had had a father, and she had been very fond of him. Of course, she had had a mother too, but that was long ago. Pippi's mother had died when Pippi was just a tiny baby lying in her cradle and howling so dreadfully that no one would come near. Pippi believed that her mother now lived somewhere up in heaven and looked down on her little girl through a hole in it. Pippi often used to wave up to her and say, "Don't worry, I can look after myself." Pippi hadn't forgotten her father. He had been a ship's captain and sailed on a great ocean. Pippi had sailed with him on his boat at least until the time he had blown into the sea during a storm and disappeared. But Pippi was quite sure that one day he would come back, for she never believed that he had drowned. She was certain that he had come ashore on a desert island, one with lots and lots of cannibals, and that her father had become king of them all and went about all day with a gold crown on his head.
"My father is a cannibal king. There aren't many children with so fine a father," said Pippi, really pleased with herself. "And when my father has built himself a boat, he'll come to fetch me, and then I shall become a cannibal princess. What a life it will be."
Pippi Longstocking by Astrid Lindgren is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB library, including as TB16158, narrated by Tanya Emery. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yes, I love David Sedaris, and everything that he's written I've read many times and I go back to it. Recently I read his latest collection of texts called Calypso, and it was brilliant. And I both laughed and cried because it was a bit sad too. I really want to read that again.
Three of my sisters visited us in Sussex the Christmas of 2012, so Gretchen and Amy took a guest room each. Hugh and I gave Lisa the master bedroom and moved next door to the converted stable I use as my office. One of the things he noted during their stay was that, with the exception of Amy and me, no one in my family ever says good night. Rather, they just leave the room, sometimes halfway through dinner, and reappear the following morning. My sisters were considered my guests, but because there was a group of them, and they could easily entertain one another, I was more or less free to go about my business, not that I didn't spend time with them. In various pairings, we went on walks and bike rides, but otherwise they sat in the living room talking or gathered in the kitchen to study Hugh at the stove. I joined them for a while and then explained that I had some work to do. This meant going next door to the stable, where I'd switch on my computer and turn to Google, thinking, "I wonder what Russell Crowe is up to." One of the reasons I'd invited these three over, had gone so far as to buy their tickets, was that this felt like a last hurrah. Except for Paul, who has no passport, but tells me with great certainty that according to an electrician he met on a job site, it is possible to buy one at the airport. We are all in our 50s now. Health-wise, we've been fortunate, but it's just a matter of time before our luck runs out and one of us gets cancer. Then we'll be picked off like figures at a shooting gallery. Easy targets, given the lives we've led.
Calypso, written and narrated by David Sedaris, is out now wherever you buy your books. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yeah, I recently read a book. It was an author called Sheila Heaty. She's American, and it's called Motherhood, and that's what it's about. I read it as an essay rather than a novel, but it's called a novel. It's about the big decision in a woman's life. Should I become a mother or not? And what will be gained and what will be lost if I choose to or choose not to? It's really good.
Is the time to start it now? Yes. Here in Toronto? Yes. So then there's nothing to be worried about? Yes. Yes, there's nothing to be worried about? No. Should I be worried? Yes. What should I be worried about? My soul? Yes. Will reading help my soul? Yes. Will being quiet help my soul? Yes. Will this book help my soul? Yes. So then I'm doing everything right? No. Am I handling my relationship wrong? No. Am I wrong in ignoring the suffering of others? No. Am I wrong in ignoring the political world? No. Am I wrong in not being grateful for the life I have? Yes. And the things I can do with it, having this time and prosperity? No. Having my particular being? Yes. Is the time for worrying about my particular being over? Yes. Is this the time to begin thinking about the soul of time? Yes. Do I have everything I need to begin? Yes. Should I start at the beginning and move straight through to the end? No. Should I do whatever I feel like, then stitch it all together later? No. Should I start at the beginning, not knowing what will come next? Yes. Is this conversation the beginning? Yes. How about those rolls of colored tape Erica bought me, sitting over there? Should I use them somehow? No. Should I just let them sit there and look at them? No. Should I give them back to her? No. Should I hide them from sight? Yes. In the cupboard? Yes.
Motherhood, written and narrated by Sheila Heaty, is out now in audiobook, print and ebook wherever books are sold. Carolina Sitterwell, thank you so much for sharing your love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you.
Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.